Hello everyone, welcome to this webinar sponsored by the Migration Policy Institute's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, Strategic Opportunities for Including English Learners in ESSA State Accountability Plans. I'm Margie McHugh, the director of the center, and I will be moderating today's webinar. Before we get into some of the introductions and of speakers and their presentations, you'll see here this logistics slide. It tells you where you can find slides and audio from today's webinar. That's the main MPI website address is www.migrationpolicy.org. If you have any problems accessing the webinar, we're covering that phone number that you see there, 202-266-1929, so you can call in there or email us at the events@migrationpolicy.org email address. And then we love it when our webinar participants use the Q&A chat function during the webinar, because it just lets us sort of triage and set up the questions for the speakers for the Q&A portion that follows their presentations. You can also send actual questions to that events@migrationpolicy.org website, and we'll be able to include them in the queue for the speakers at the end. So as I said, my name is Margie McHugh, and I'll simply be moderating today. And then you'll be able to hear from first Delia Pompa, who is a Senior Fellow for Education Policy here at MPI. Delia has spent her career working on English learner issues and more broadly improving education and life opportunities for immigrant and English learner children, and we are just so thrilled that she's here at MPI with us now after her storied career working on these issues and really helping to helping us at this moment when so much is changing in terms of policy. And then we are also thrilled that Dr. Susan Lyons from the National Center for the Improvement of Educational Assessment is with us. She has been deeply involved in supporting states as they transition their assessment and accountability systems under the new ESSA law. She works with many state technical advisory committees, accountability work groups, and the like. And so we're just so eager to have the amount of content and insight that she has available to everyone through this webinar today. Before I turn it over to Delia, I'm just very quickly, in terms of setup, for those of you who aren't kind of aware of the broader mission and work of our Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, we certainly do focus primarily in what we call the education pipeline and issues there in terms of how do policies and practices at the national, state, and local levels actually support the integration of immigrants and their children. We also have a fairly big focus on supporting folks inside state and local governments who are working on language access issues, and for many years have been trying to work to improve the governance of integration policy, both at the federal level and working with state and local entities that are trying to do the same. In terms of our work on English learner, dual language learner, ESSA type issues, I just wanted to flag for you that today we have put up a new ESSA webpage that pulls together a number of different products that MPI has around ESSA implementation. So you'll find a set of state fact sheets there, several commentaries, recordings of related webinars, and that's where the recording from today's webinar will go. We also have an ELL Information Center that has a variety of fact sheets that look at demographics and number of ELLs by state, those sorts of indicators. And then we have a wide range of early childhood reports, data analyses, and the like. Most recently, a report and some state fact sheets on two-generation approaches, also forthcoming reports on ECEC pathway programs for immigrant and refugee workers who are in the early childhood field, and also a report on state quality rating systems and the extent to which they are reflecting some of the linguistic and cultural competence, the need for better linguistic and cultural competence sensitivity in how programs are assessed and related. And then very quickly, I'll also say that we've launched a great new project, National Partnership to Improve Pre-K to 12 Immigrants' Student Success, where we're working with leading immigrant and refugee policy organizations in 7 states to help them become more knowledgeable and engaged in policy issues around immigrant and ELL education. And we also sponsor a private learning network on newcomer youth success that about 30 school districts around the country participate in, where there's school districts that receive a large number of immigrant newcomer students that arrive middle school or later, and so there's a lot of special practices associated with helping those students succeed, and we're working to promote sharing and learning across districts that are dealing with providing excellent services to those youth. Phew, so with that, I would just say please go to the website if you're interested in more on this. And then I'd like to turn it over to Delia. We've been really trying to be on top of the changes that have happened under the Every Student Succeeds Act and what they mean for ELLs. And Delia is going to get us into that right away before we then turn to Susan. So Delia, over to you.
Hi, everyone. It is good to talk with you, and I hope to hear lots of questions from you at the end. I am going to, we all are going to today, go one level deeper than we've been going. You've attended a webinar certainly that we've had perhaps and other webinars and other informational sessions on what's contained in the law. Today we're going to go one level deeper and start talking about the implications, the connections, the questions that stakeholders should be asking their state, the questions the state should be asking themselves. This is particularly timely given the vote that was just taken in the Senate where the rules for accountability that were set up by the Department of Education were overturned. So I think this is a good time to be looking at what kinds of input stakeholders should have. It is, I think, a reflection of the devolution of power to the state with regard to accountability, that we're going to have much more input as stakeholders. The fact that the decisions are going to be open, I would say wide open in many ways regarding lots of aspects of the Every Student Succeeds Act, means that stakeholders need to be very engaged, need to understand what decisions states are making and why they're making them. Today we're going to focus on the English Language Proficiency Indicator because it is the biggest change that we saw in the law that affects English learners. It is one of the 5 key indicators of success that states have to account for in their accountability system. The goals within that indicator are going to be set by the state, are being set by the state actually as we speak, and it really does result in a higher profile for English learners in each state, because, again, it is now part of the overall accountability for the state. This is the first time English language proficiency and the success of English learners in that area is going to be mirrored in the entire accountability system under Title I. So that is an important piece of where all of us should be providing input and looking at the complexities behind it. So speaking of the complexities behind it, this looks like a pretty simple statement, and it is on the face. This is what the law says about the English Language Proficiency Indicator and what it represents. If you look at the pieces of that phrase, you find what's important. Progress in achieving English, defined by the state, measured by the ELP or English Language Proficiency Exam within a state-determined timeline. So many, many decisions will be made by the state. This is, again, all these decisions are an opportunity for stakeholders, first to understand and have input into a state overall theory of action about English learner achievement. This particular indicator and all those elements that I talked about within that definition, within that phrase, reflect something about what the state believes about English learner achievement. And it is important that as stakeholders we understand what that overall belief system is and have input into it. When the state started making decisions about English language proficiency, because as I said, they are making the decisions. You all probably know that states may turn in their state plans as early as April 3rd. There are 18 states turning in their plans then. They have to define each of those pieces within that phrase, within that plan. The other states are going to turn it in by September, so there is an opportunity for input even for those states that are turning in their plans April 3rd, because many of them are currently under review. For that reason, I think it's really exciting, and we're fortunate to have Susan Lyons from the Center for Assessment talk to us today about these complexities. That little phrase in there packs a big punch when one starts looking at each of those decisions in there and how they relate to each other and their long-term implications. So Susan, I'm going to turn it over to you, and thank you for being here with us today.
Great. Thank you, Delia and Margie. It's certainly an honor to be speaking with all of you today. Before I get into it, I'd first like to acknowledge my collaboration with the Latino Policy Forum in Illinois and the support I've received from the High Quality Assessment Project to write a white paper that outlines many of the issues that states should be considering regarding English learners as they draft their ESSA plans. That paper has much more information and goes much deeper than everything we'll be able to cover in the webinar today. And the good thing is it's expected to be released publicly within the next 2 weeks. So I can make sure that MPI has a copy of that so it can be distributed to their network. And of course, you can always reach out to me if you have further questions or would like a copy. So I'm going to start with a heuristic to help show all of the major pieces that influence the ELP indicator. So this figure illustrates that it's not just the statistical growth model that's used to operationalize the ELP indicator, but it's also the state context and the business rules that support the implementation of the model that all play a role in determining school performance classification on the English language proficiency. So everything related to the state context, the statistical model, and the business rules will interact in order to make consequential decisions about school classification and performance. So the state context deals with the on-the-ground reality of ELLs within the state. For example, are English learners concentrated in a small number of schools? Are they spread across many schools? Are they concentrated in particular grade levels? Each of these realities within your state will interact with the statistical model and business rules and should be considered and modeled in advance before making decisions about the final statistical model use. When I'm talking about the statistical model, I'm really talking about the methodology that's used to produce the scores based on the English language proficiency assessment. So this area encompasses both the class of the model used, right? Are you using a value-added model or a growth-to-target model? And the particular way that model is specified and estimated. So for example, does the model control for student characteristics? And if so, what student characteristics are controlled for you? So you can see this gets pretty complex really quickly. So it's important that you as stakeholders are aware of these different decisions that states are making related to this indicator so you can be asking the right question. And Delia is going to be spending a lot of time at the end of this presentation talking about the areas and questions that you can probe to understand the consequences of each of these decisions on ultimately fairness for schools and students. And then finally, the business rules specify how the results of the statistical model will be aggregated into an indicator and then also aggregated into a summative determination for school. So for example, this includes the minimum end size, how many L students are needed before a school receives a score, or will the results be pooled over years? Will reclassify the Ls that have already reached proficiency be included in the aggregation? So as you can see, the information in any one of these colored boxes can inform decisions in another box. So for example, if there are few EL students per school, the state may want to consider choosing a smaller N size in order to provide ratings to as many schools and the highest percentage of ELs as possible. Of course, many of you know this causes issues with precision due to the small sample sizes. So these are the types of trade-offs that are common in making decisions, and states will need to weigh the positives and negatives associated with any particular approach. So let's talk a little bit about the growth modeling option. So this is that statistical model, the middle box in the heuristic I just showed. So the law requires that an indicator of progress in achieving English language proficiency be used. So this requirement has generally been understood as requiring the quantification of across-year changes in individual student performance or growth. So if we take this understanding, we can use prior work on examining the different growth models that has been done for the general student population, and we find it generally applicable. However, we should be reevaluating that body of research in light of the unique characteristics associated with English learners and also the English language proficiency indicator itself. Pete Goldschmidt and Kenji Hakuda recently released a paper that evaluates the options of typical growth indicators from a predominantly technical perspective. So they look at how these indicators could be used for the ELP indicator from a technical perspective. In the forthcoming paper that I just mentioned, we build on this work by integrating their perspective with additional considerations related to the implementation and the evaluation of the English language proficiency indicator within the context of the full accountability system. So in the interest of time, I'll just briefly review some of the discussion in that paper by highlighting three of the different growth modeling options states are considering. So I'll talk about value tables, or transition tables as they're listed here, value added models, and growth to target models. The key point in the table presented on this slide is really just to highlight the fact that the choice in the growth model is not inconsequential. States need to be carefully considering the benefits and drawbacks of each choice, along with the different growth inferences generated by the different models. The growth inference supported by the chosen model should clearly align to the state's theory of action for how including the ELP indicator within the accountability system will or is intended to lead to progress toward the desired outcomes for ELs in particular. So I'll briefly now just go through some of the considerations of each of these models. Starting with value tables, the growth inference that you get out of a value table is how valued is the observed growth as measured by progress on the performance level. And so one of the primary benefits of a value table for the ELP indicator is its transparency for schools and stakeholders. Once schools know how their students have scored on the English language proficiency assessment, it is really quite simple for them to figure out and easily calculate what their performance on this indicator will be. And that's really beneficial for schools who are looking to really closely monitor their progress and figure out how to best support their EL. Additionally, and this is particularly useful, if the values are set in a way that reflects the state's theory of action. So for example, schools can be clearly incentivized and rewarded to improve English language proficiency for those students who typically have the most difficulty showing growth. So you can award higher values to growth that is more difficult to achieve, and that really drives changes in behavior at the school level. However, one of the drawbacks of using a value table to measure growth is that the methodology does not really easily lend itself to the creation of individual student targets aligned to the state's defined timeline for reaching proficiency. And as Delia just informed us, the regs have been overturned, And this was a requirement outlined in the regulations that there be this tight connection between your student level targets used to track progress towards the state-defined long-term goal and the ELP indicator. Now that the regulations are not going to be enforced, states have a little bit more flexibility to incorporate a growth model that doesn't necessarily include student level targets, and then generate a separate mechanism for defining student level targets for the purpose of tracking progress towards the state long-term goal. And I know that kind of gets a little bit complex, but ultimately the message is that states now have more flexibility to include the growth model that they think most closely aligns with their theory of action, whether or not it allows for sort of this easy incorporation of student level targets. You can use value tables to create student level targets. However, it does become pretty complex and unwieldy quickly, especially as you take into account student characteristics that might influence student level targets. For example, their grade level, their age, their native language proficiency, and so on. Okay, so the next is value-added models. And the growth inference associated with value-added models is how effective is the EL program. Now again, we're not talking about the student here, we're talking about the program level effect as eliciting student growth compared to other programs serving similar students in the state. So one of the benefits of the value-added modeling framework for this indicator in particular is that states can easily take into account student level characteristics. So the same characteristics I just mentioned, such as grade, age, native language proficiency, limited or interrupted education. And these have been shown to be relevant for explaining EL language acquisition. So this has the potential benefit of helping to sort of level the playing field for schools. Another real benefit of the value-added model for the growth indicator is the fact that it's normative in nature. And so this might be significant for those states that are administering the WIDA 2.0 as their English language proficiency assessment. So if states are really not substantially modifying their exit criteria for EL proficiency, then the increase in the WIDA 2.0 performance standards is likely to lead to a larger percentage of students failing to exit the EL programming. So in other words, a higher percentage of students are likely to not be meeting the new proficiency standard unless the exit criteria has been adjusted. So if this is the case, the normative growth models, such as value-added models or student growth percentiles, can still provide for a meaningful differentiation among schools. However, more criterion-referenced models, such as value tables or growth-to-target models, will likely lead to, over time, low performance for all schools. And when that happens, we're sort of decreasing the variability that the model reveals, and it decreases the ability of the indicator to sort of effectively discriminate among programs that are doing better or not as well with their EL students. So this is certainly something to consider in conjunction with the state's exit criteria. Some of the drawbacks of using value-added models for the English language proficiency indicator include the lack of transparency for schools and stakeholders. It can be a black box, as we've seen with some states have tried to do this with teacher evaluation. And also, sometimes it's a high cost in terms of time, resources, and capacity to really develop and implement these types of complex models. And like value tables, value-added models may be difficult to explicitly link to the state's long-term goals and measures of interim progress. And so again, it's okay to do now that the regulations have been overturned, but the state will need to be able to come up with another mechanism for creating student-level targets in order to track progress towards long-term goals. And finally, we have the growth-to-target model. And so this model, the inference derived is the student on track to achieve English language proficiency within the state defined timeline? And often for the school level inference is what percentage of students are on track to achieve English language proficiency within the state defined timeline? And you can see there is a real close link here with how the long-term goals as required by ESSA are operationalized. And that's really one of the clear strengths of the growth to target model. It's this tight connection with the state's long-term goals and measures of interim progress. One of the potential drawbacks of the growth to proficiency model is sort of our limited understanding of the ambitious yet reasonable growth trajectories for acquiring English language proficiency. So the meaningfulness of the indicator for differentiating among schools and English language program quality really depends on the care that's taken to appropriately define the student level growth trajectories and then the interim targets that are set along those trajectories. So because of this, this metric is particularly susceptible to losing the ability to really capture true differences among schools if the trajectories are somehow unrealistic or not based on research of student learning. So this is especially true if the majority of English learners are not likely to reach proficiency due to the increased stringency of the proficiency standard. So if a state is going to go with the growth to target model, the best recommendation is to really look at the research to say, what does the research say about the realistic course of language acquisition, not only for English learners, but for the types of English learners I have, and how can I set realistic trajectories for my students based on what I know about them? And then also modeling your existing data that you have within your state. So really looking to past trends of growth for EL students to make sure that there's not something distinct about your student that the body of literature out there is not capturing. So once one or more indicators of progress towards English language proficiency have been selected for consideration by your state, the state should really undergo a systematic process for evaluating both the political feasibility and the technical quality of each of the potential metrics that are under consideration. So this means that in the evaluation of any growth model, states not only need to consider the technical aspects of the model, but the political and contextual considerations, such as how it supports the vision for effective instruction, how the accountability system will use the growth model to support those efforts, as well as the capacity the state has to effectively implement and communicate about the particular model to schools and stakeholders. So for the policy-based criteria, states should be holding internal discussions about values and capacity, as well as hosting formal stakeholder engagement sessions where a lot of you come in to allow for public input into the choice of indicator. Additionally, discussions with educators will also be informative for understanding how the choice of the metric may drive intended or unintended changes in behavior, which is ultimately what this is all about if our accountability system is going to be successful at achieving our goals, our policy goals for EL students. The technical-based criteria should also be evaluated, and this can be done by modeling existing data to make predictions about the potential implications of the different modeling decisions. So you can use past data on the English language proficiency assessment to test run the different model options, and this will allow the state to better understand the utility of each growth model for providing valid and reliable scores that can accurately represent progress across schools. Once the statistical model for quantifying progress has been chosen, there are a number of equally consequential decisions that must be made about how the English language proficiency indicator will then factor into the larger school accountability system. And so we suggest that the driving question guiding these decisions should be, which solution would lead to outcomes that are most likely to promote growth towards English language proficiency for ELs while also prioritizing fairness? And in accountability design, it's important to consider this question both from the lens of schools and also from the lens of the English learners themselves. So both of these notions of fairness are essential to consider within the accountability system, and sometimes they can be at odds with one another. So there may be trade-offs between the competing goals of incentivizing desirable behaviors to benefit EL, while also ensuring that the system is set up so that it's fair for all schools, no matter their demographics. So on the next slide, Delia will go through key decision points that should involve stakeholder input. At each of these junctions, stakeholders should be encouraging states to carefully consider the consequences of each decision, not only for schools and school classification, but also for what it's likely to mean for EL students and what school-level behaviors are likely to be incentivized or discouraged on behalf of EL as a result of each of these decisions. So Delia, I'll pass it back to you if I can.
And as we were preparing not only this PowerPoint presentation, but also as we have been working with stakeholders across the country, we have been facing the fact that this is a very complex process, and not all stakeholders have the level of technical knowledge that is necessary to dig deep, deep, deep into what decisions are being made and what the psychometric and accountability considerations are and statistical considerations. So what we are trying to do at MPI along with other partners is to look at areas that stakeholders might ask questions about, and these areas are key to some of the more complex issues that Susan was talking about. Now, that doesn't mean that that we shouldn't be looking at these more complex processes. And I think Susan's paper is going to be very useful in that. Also, MPI will be putting out a shorter paper that talks about how stakeholders can understand the processes. This paper will be released along with our partners at the Education Trust and other partners in the Business Civil Rights Coalition that's been working together on ESSA. Those two papers, Susan's and the MPI paper, will be out in the next couple of weeks, so you should look for them on the website that Margie talked about. So let's look at questions you could ask that perhaps simplify some of what Susan was talking about, but certainly make it more concrete. The first thing that requires stakeholder input is the first thing a state should be thinking about when it thinks about its accountability system, and that's the theory of action. The theory of action is not just about what the accountability system is going to look like and what decisions are made about models, but it is about the entire picture. The entire picture includes what kind of instruction takes place in our schools. Is it good enough now, or does it need to improve? Is our accountability model going to capture the changes that are necessary? How does that impact teacher training? What do we expect of our English learners? Where are English learners from? What do we know about how long it generally takes them to move toward English proficiency and to reach English proficiency? So all of this should be reflected in a big picture that the state has about its English learners, not an isolated look at accountability itself. And as a stakeholder, it's important that we ask those questions of the state to look at what the entire theory of action is about English learners and their achievement. A second question that is concrete that we can ask about is the weight of the ELP indicator in the overall accountability system. As I mentioned early on, and as most of you know, there are five key indicators that states have to account for. But the state is allowed to determine what the weight of those indicators are. Particularly in states where there are many, many English learners, and also particularly in states where there are few English learners, what weight that ELP indicator is given says a lot about how the state values the achievement of these children. It also says a lot about what we will know about achievement for English learners through the accountability system. So it is a good question to ask. It's a good thing to look for in your state plan. Just as Susan has been working with other states, a number of other groups have, and what we're finding as we work with the states is the weight varies across the states. I do believe that many states are being very thoughtful about how they assign this weight, but it does bear looking at if you're a stakeholder. A third area that is concrete and that we should be looking at is an area that is also very complex, as Susan pointed out, and that is the decisions about goals and timelines for English proficiency. The process of establishing these goals for English proficiency is where most states start out making decisions about the ELP indicator. What is their goal? Where do they want students to be in what period of time when it comes to English proficiency? Then you start looking at what the interim goals are on a year-by-year basis. Those interim goals signal whether a school is meeting the standards set by the state, and so it also signals how that school is going to reflect achievement within the accountability system. So it's important that stakeholders who have working knowledge of how students acquire English and what instruction looks like in a state have some input into what those goals should be and what the timeline should be. Another piece to look at here reflects on what Susan said about fairness and about what we know about our students in terms of setting ambitious goals. Even though we've had goals for English learners in the past, we as stakeholders have a responsibility to look at whether those goals have been not only reasonable, but whether they've been based in research. The same thing for the timeline. So this is an important area for stakeholders to look at and to have a lot of input into for their state. Another area that is a concrete that you can look at and make decisions about on your own as a stakeholder group and also give input is N-size. Susan mentioned N size is one of the factors that you look at when you're looking at the business rules. N size, as you know, is the size of the group that determines whether it goes into the accountability system. The law says that it must be 30 or below. But the N size really determines a number of decisions or plays on a number of decisions within the accountability system. Not only does it determine whether English learners are going to be counted in the accountability system, it also says something about how the state understands the distribution of its English learners and how the N size and who's counted in the accountability system allows schools to be represented fairly. It is important that as you're looking at N size in your state, you understand the distribution of English learners in your state. Are all the English learners in one area and the preponderance of them and then unevenly distributed across the rest of the state? What is that? What are the implications for N size? Does that mean you should have a lower N size so you capture more students? For those people who are concerned about stability of data, if your N size is too low, there are a number of authors, including Pete Goldschmidt and others, who have talked about the trade-off and how sometimes you need to make decisions about how many students you are including versus what the stability looks like. I think there are ways around. Many states are taking some creative approaches to N size. They're setting sort of a mid-level N size, but then looking at second steps of putting together groups of students to get more kids into the N size pool, into the pool that's going to count. Also, some states are aggregating data across years. So there are lots of different ways around this, but it's important to understand how your state is making that decision and what the implications are for kids and for schools. It's also important to note here whether they're looking at their own data. That question is going to come up a lot as we look at the decisions the states are making. Are they looking at their own data in the state? The next few areas for input are not directly tied to the English language proficiency indicator. They're really more tied to the academic indicator and how English learners count in that English language arts and math accountability area. So whether English learners, former English learners, are included in the accountability system has a direct weight on what their scores look like in the under the academic indicator. As you know probably, the law allows inclusion of English learners up to 4 years after they have exited English learner status. This has the benefit of raising the score overall for English learners for obvious reasons. These are kids who have exited and have already shown English proficiency. But it also has the drawback sometimes of masking how current English learners are doing. So as a stakeholder, you may want to provide input on how those two groups are represented in the accountability system. It's also important to look at what the data says about former English learners. This is an important area that the state needs to do some examination of how including English learners impacts the scores overall. Including former English learners impacts the scores overall of English learners as a group. And that's something easy for the state to do, is to look at, to do some runs, including them for a variety of years and figuring out what kind of difference it makes. Another key area for stakeholder input is the inclusion of recently arrived English learners. These are students who, under the law, who've been here 12 months or less, here meaning in a U.S. school. The law applies to options that states are looking at and can choose. One is to include them the first year in assessment, but not report out, and then report a growth number the next year. The other is to exclude them the first year and then to include them in the accountability the second year. Lots of questions about that and who your English learners are and their background goes into that decision, and you should be ready to make those kinds that give that input to the state. Finally, another key area is looking at entry-exit criteria. The timelines and goals are very directly tied to entry-exit criteria for a state. Reclassification is also tied to this, so it's another important area. I want to move on very quickly because I want to leave time for your questions. But here are questions that are key to ask your state, and these are the big questions. First of all, we kept referring to, Susan and I, using existing data. It's important to look at what existing data your state has to be able to make decisions, what kinds of modeling you can do, they can do, what kind of historical trends there have been. All of that needs to inform decision-making in the accountability system. It reflects such aspects as distribution of English learners in the state, past growth and proficiency, the power of instruction in your state. All those things are things you should look at. Susan mentioned the trade-offs associated with each decision. Very, very important to look at when decisions are being made about any group, but in this case, particularly English learners, what are the trade-offs that are being made? What are students losing and what are they gaining? What are schools losing and what are they gaining? And size is a good example of that. Both Susan and I talked about that. A next big question to ask your state is what the impact of the decision will be on students. In the past, we have seen unintended consequences when it comes to accountability decisions regarding English learners. Unfortunately, in some areas, states or districts under-identifying students because of the accountability system. In other cases, not including all English learners in the accountability system. It's important to look at the impact of all these decisions and what the unintended consequences might be and how one controls for that, how the state can control for those unintended consequences. The impact of the decision on schools is question to ask the state, and that is what the are to address English learner needs in the state plan in addition to your ELP indicator. And that would be looking at the academic indicators, looking at the area of parent engagement, graduation rates, early childhood education, teacher training. So it goes beyond accountability, and the plan has many, many opportunities for input on English learners. I think now we're going to go to questions. Sorry we had to rush through that. This is a complex area, so we would be happy to answer your questions at this point.
Great. Thank you so much, Delia and Susan. That was just a lot of really, really terrific information. So folks, please remember to keep sending in your questions. You can see there the either send them to events@migrationpolicy.org or use the Q&A function that you have there as part of the webinar platform. So Delia and Susan, a lot of the questions we've gotten are ones that either of you might be able to take. So let me just start with this one, and maybe Susan, you might want to take a whack at it first. So one question was that that there was a state that's considering student growth percentiles among other options in terms of the for their accountability system. So could you speak a bit to the drawbacks of that approach?
Hi, sure. Absolutely happy to, Margie. Thank you. So the student growth percentiles model is a norm referenced model. And so that means that it's not tied explicitly to any sort of target or goal or performance level, but instead compares EL growth to, or it quantifies their growth relative to other ELs with similar histories of prior achievement and says sort of how they're doing relative to similar English learners. One of the benefits of this approach is that for states that have, it sort of takes away the necessity to set out realistic growth trajectories for ELs. And when you have a high percentage of ELs that are unlikely to exit based on the increased proficiency standard, you're still able to meaningfully differentiate among schools. If the state really is hoping to closely link their measures on the long-term goal to their annual indicator, the student growth percentile framework allows for the creation of something called adequate growth percentiles, which sort of integrates the growth to target model within the student growth percentiles framework. I won't go into too much detail on that, but it is a nice way to sort of marry student growth percentiles and the growth to target to sort of get the benefits of the growth to target while maintaining the norm reference nature of student growth percentiles. So you have a sense of how difficult it would be for a student to reach the intended target within the given number of years. Some of the drawbacks of the student growth percentile model, one of the main drawbacks I see is that there's no real mechanism to easily incorporate student-level characteristics that might be significant to include when wishing to understand the growth of EL students. Those characteristic or demographic factors such as age, grade, you know, level of native language proficiency, limited or interrupted formal education, all of these factors are likely to play a role in determining student growth trajectories, and those just aren't sort of easily incorporated into the student growth percentile framework.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Susan. So so another one that either or both of you might want to take a whack at is what considerations might be important for schools and districts that have high numbers of late arriving newcomers?
Whack at it, and then Susan can add something. First of all, it's important to determine whether these students, what grade level they're at and what their English level is when they come in to the school system. When you look at the different areas for input, one of the first areas one might look at is whether you're going to test those students the first year or whether you're going to exempt them. And that decision has a lot to do with what information you want about them. If you exempt them, then you're not going to have any information on their achievement that first year, although you won't have to assess them. If you test them, you have the opportunity to look at growth over a year. And I think we all know that students, when they are at low levels of English, make a lot of progress that first year. The implications really are not only about English proficiency, but the academic assessment and how you want to model your accountability plan so that you're able to take into account how you think these students are going to perform. One way to do that is to look at the history of these students, of newcomers in your district. Another way to look at that is to go back to your theory of action and to look at what kinds of instructional programs you have in place and whether those have been effective enough. And another is to look at, as I said, how you're going to include them overall. And whether the group you're talking about is large enough to fit in under the N size. I think sometimes what is large in one district is not large in another district, depending on the concentration. So I think all those things come together to make a decision about those kids. Susan, would you add anything else?
I think those considerations are exactly right. From the perspective of the fairness for schools and ensuring comparability across schools in the accountability system, one additional consideration you might want to take into account is ensuring that the state model, whatever the statistical model they choose for the English language proficiency indicator, accounts for the fact that these are late arrivals. Because you know that the language acquisition of these students will look much different than the language acquisition of students arriving in kindergarten, and you want to make sure that you're not penalized on the basis of the demographics of the students you're serving.
So Susan, I think then a more global question from folks, even though I think everyone's sort of acknowledging that a lot of this is very unique to the circumstances in different states, but is it going to come out in the papers that the white paper that you're doing or the other one that Delia was referencing, but are there any sort of typical ways of weighting former L's or of setting N sizes, or are any of the growth models that you talked about, are any of them being used by a majority, for example, of states because they're seen as that there are some better approaches that states are gravitating towards?
Sure. So this is highly state context dependent, particularly when you're thinking about the minimum N size. As Delia mentioned, the regulations require that if a state shows a minimum N size of greater than 30, they'd have to provide sort of a rationale for that decision. But beyond that, there really aren't many rules of thumb. We're actually at the Center for Assessment yesterday internally brainstorming some sort of rules of thumb we could come up with in terms of N size and the weight of the indicator. And really, it's quite difficult to do because of the distribution of EL students across the country is so different from state to state.
Right.
And those contextual factors really do interact.
Right.
I know the WIDA Consortium has developed a growth to target model that they're interested in promoting across the states that use WIDA. I haven't spoken directly with Gary Cook, who's responsible for that model, but if I were a state that's part of the WIDA Consortium and interested in using the growth to target, I would be really careful about, one, how your state's setting exit criteria for proficiency given the new increase in the standards, and also asking really deep questions about how the growth trajectories or the projected growth trajectories to that target are set We know that those trajectories might not be linear. They're certainly not going to be the same for all different types of EL students, and so we want to make sure that we're being really sensitive to those factors.
Great. And then, Delia, maybe this one for you. There's some, not surprisingly, some interest in getting a little more clarity on the impact of the votes in the Senate and the House. So could you just say a little bit more about what's likely to happen now that Congress has overturned the regulations, and can states still use those regulations to guide their plans?
I think the first thing to acknowledge is that, in particular for English learners, much of the change is in the law. So that's not change. That's not going to be taken away, or it's not going to limit what a plan can do. Much of what was in the regulation provided more clarity and was really a reflection of best practice. The states are still free to do that. And in looking at the states that I've been working with, many are looking at those issues regardless of whether they were in the regulations or not. So take, for example, what states take into account when they're looking at growth toward English proficiency. The law required only looking at the level of language proficiency kids had as they were going into this. But other states, many states are taking into account other factors, and these are factors that were defined in the regs, and there are factors that are important. So I think many states who are making decisions based on their historical practice, their data that they have, and what their data tells them, and also what they see as best practice, and their theory of action. So if under their theory of action, it's important for them to beef up what's being offered English learners because they know that the standards have gone up, they might account for all the many other permutations besides what level. They might look at grade. They might look at how long the student has been in the country. There are many other things that people are looking at because it is best practice. So my answer to you, the basic answer, is that as stakeholders, we should encourage best practice because there are many, many things you can do that go beyond the law just because of the range of responsibility and the authority states have in designing their own plans.
Great. And then we have a few specific situations that folks are in that they're looking for advice on. So one is, what if you're in a state that's waiting for a new assessment to be released to set goals and timelines for English language proficiency? What should stakeholders do in that situation? And then also there's a state that's already drafted and closed the comment period on their plan. So what might the areas of priority on engagement be as they move into early implementation?
I'll take a stab at the first question. There are a number of states who are in a consortium that has just redone their tests, and they as I've looked at plans, many of the states are saying that they can't set targets yet. What they can do is look at the English proficiency assessments they have been using and look at what that trajectory has looked like for kids under that assessment and make some set up some temporary targets based on that. It is possible in the state plan to say you're going to adjust something when you get your new information. So I would say there's still room for states to include some targets knowing they're going to change after a couple of years or after more data is available.
Sure, in regards to the second question, one of the benefits for local school districts is that if your school has been identified as in need of targeted support, even though your state plan has already been finalized and submitted, there really is a good deal of flexibility when it comes to what the local school district plan is going to be to support those subgroups that have been identified as struggling or consistently underperforming. And so I would encourage stakeholders to really work closely with their local school district and school leaders to make sure that those plans are really thought out well and supporting ELs in the way that is going to be appropriate and ultimately moving them towards their long-term goals.
Okay, that so much terrific information and great advice on these last few questions. So I think we're going to need to wrap here, given the time. I just want to say, first, you see those resources that are newly up on MPI's website as of today. We'll be getting up the recording of the webinar and the PowerPoints shortly. And we also promise that we'll get Susan's white paper to everyone who signed up for the webinar when it's published. And if we didn't get to your questions, we will. There are a few that we didn't get to, so we'll sort of route them to the appropriate speakers from today and get answers for you. So just want to say a very big thank you, first of all, to Susan and to Delia for all of the great information, and to all of you who joined, and for the great work that you're all doing on the front lines. It was really gratifying to see how many school districts and immigrant and refugee leadership groups and the like had signed up for today. So we wish everyone great success in their work trying to really shape the way the law is implemented to make sure that it is that we wind up with some very fair systems for helping EL kids along in getting the English proficiency they need. You see there our contact information. Susan's is earlier on the slide that was up with her bio. So feel free to be in touch. And again, many thanks to everyone for taking part in this. Bye-bye.